So it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the inaugural 2026 CIPL Seminars of the Year. I'm David Erdos. I co-direct the Centre for IP and Information Law, and also teach and research data protection. And therefore, to me, Tim Pickpayne really needs no introduction at all. He's been a very leading figure in information law, sort of operating across the piece, really, with parties in the private sector, in the public sector, the regulator, but also appearing both for and against the regulator in lots of leading cases. The Clearview case, which is now going on, springs to mind, but also cases like Dixon Stores and Common Services and many others. Often involving, I think, the detail of the law in a way which few can match. And that's brought him into interchange over a very long period of time. I remember meeting Tim as we were both reminiscing back in the early 2010s, and he was very much established even then, into interaction with academics and the academic world. And so As a KC, as a leading silk, as a practitioner, I can think of no one better to begin the year in terms of ensuring that common debate very much continues. And the theme of the common debate tonight, which is on automated individual decision-making rights, is a really live one, and a really live one for practice. You know, it's really bubbling away and growing, and a really, really live one in academia. Almost everything seems to come back to AI and where things are going in the law. And of course, we have UK reform here. We are recording. Tim has kindly agreed to record the lecture, and we'll be putting that online. We won't be putting the subsequent discussion online. So I very much encourage you all to participate, those of you who have come in person, and also through the question features. You can keep the questions coming as the talk goes on, and we'll be picking those up after Tim's presentation. But you've heard far much enough from me. I will now hand over to Tim, and I'm looking forward to the talk.
So thank you very much, David, for that kind introduction. I should say I'm not going to be using PowerPoint. That was quite a confession when I got here. Nobody's lynched me for that yet. And arguably, my title is a catastrophically bad piece of marketing, because it really is designed to make the subject sound as dull as possible. Who even remembers what GDPR Article 22 is all about? What I should have said, I think, is, should we care about having decisions made about us by intelligent systems without any human intervention? And that really is a science fiction idea, isn't it? I was thinking on my way over here today that probably the first time I came across that idea was in 1978, when I watched the first episode of Blake 7, and the eponymous hero was sentenced to transportation by a judicial computer with no human intervention at all. Just briefly, I think two reasons why I think Article 22 is of interest. First of all, so what you have there is a specific right in certain circumstances not to have a decision made about you by wholly automated means. And it's not just about decisions of public authorities. It's not specifically about judicial decisions, which is what people tend to focus on. Certainly lawyers tend to focus on when we talk about automated decision-making. It extends to decision-making by data controllers generally, so private bodies, private individuals across the piece. I think the other thing that's interesting about this provision is it's recently had and survived a near-death experience. A few years back, there was a consultation with a proposal to abolish it. Instead of being abolished, it was reformed. And in fact, what I'm going to focus on today is the amended provisions, even though they're not yet in force, but the provisions that result from the Data Use and Access Act 2025. Strictly speaking, that means what we're talking about is Article 22A to 22D, because Article 22 itself is going. But I'll carry on talking about Article 22, because that's the nomenclature that I think people are more familiar with. And I want to go in four steps. I want to put Article 22 in its context a bit within the data protection framework. I want to talk more about the substantive content, particularly focusing on the amended version. I want to talk briefly about why there was a proposal to get rid of it. And then I think the thing that's most interesting is the fourth aspect, which is, well, what is this provision for? Why do we have it? What's the justification? Is there a justification? So looking at the data protection framework, within that framework, I think Article 22 is something of an outlier because it focuses on decisions. It focuses on particular kinds of decisions. In general, data protection law, the GDPR, the UK GDPR as it is now, it's not about decisions. It's about processing. It's about the processing of personal data. And that is a much wider concept. And there are all sorts of ways that you can process data without making decisions about people, e.g. just holding it or using it to generate statistics or things of that nature. When we look at the GDPR, obviously it imposes a lot of duties on the controller, the person who determines the purposes and means of processing, all sorts of things that the controller has to comply with, the data protection principles. And again, because what we're interested in data protection law is processing generally, so those provisions don't apply solely to decisions. They apply to all sorts of things that you do with data. So what that means is that if you did take Article 22 away, then decisions that were made by purely automated means wouldn't be wholly unregulated. They'd still be regulated. If they involved processing of personal data, that processing would have to comply with the general requirements of the GDPR, including, for instance, the fairness requirement. That focus specifically on decisions, I think, is one of the ways in which Article 22 is perhaps closer to a judicial review type model than it is to the GDPR generally. So if you're bringing a judicial review claim, it's always crucial to identify what is the decision that's being challenged. And exactly the same under Article 22. So it's unlike judicial review in that its scope is set by the significance or the impact of the decisions that are being taken, rather than by the categorization of the decision maker as being public or private in nature. Now, looking a bit at its substantive content, as I said, I'm going to focus on the new regime, came in with the 2025 Act, not yet in force, but will be in force at some point. And what that targets is a certain kind of decisions, significant decisions based solely on automated processing. And I'm going to use a label for that. I'll call them significant automated decisions, or SADs for short. That's not in the statute. That's my language. And Article 22A has two important definitions to help you decide what an SAD means. It says that a decision is based solely on automated processing if there's no meaningful human involvement in the taking of the decision. And it says that a decision is significant in relation to a data subject if it produces a legal effect for the data subject or has a similarly significant effect. Now, I think one can see immediately that all of that is going to need quite a lot of unpicking. Then new Article 22B to D, 22D, that basically deals with the extent to which that kind of decision, that solely automated decision, is permitted. And there are two sorts of cases. We could call them red light cases and amber light cases. There are the red light cases where that sort of decision making is just prohibited outright. There are the amber light cases where that sort of decision is allowed, but with safeguards. There are two prohibited cases. One is where the decision is based wholly or partly on the processing of special category data, though there's some carve-outs from that. And then also where the processing relies wholly or in part on the new recognised legitimate interest ground, the new basis for processing introduced by the 2025 Act. So those are the prohibited cases, the red light cases. In other cases, if you're going to engage in this solely automated decision making, you've got to adopt safeguards. And those safeguards include that you have to enable the data subject to make representations, to contest the decision, and to obtain human intervention. So what's the difference there between the red light cases and the amber light cases? In the red light case, you can't do it. So what that means is the data subject has a right to have a human in the loop, as some often described. In the amber light cases, you have a right to a human in the loop, but you have to ask for it. You have the right to ask for it, but you don't get it automatically. So there are various questions about this. What do we mean by meaningful human involvement? So the human being can't just be a rubber stamp. And interestingly, when this was going through Parliament, there was an amendment proposed at committee stage and subsequently withdrawn, which said, well, the human being has to have various sorts of qualifications. They have to have an adequate level of expertise in order for it to be meaningful human involvement. That amendment ultimately wasn't pressed. And then what is significant? What do we mean by has a significant effect on people? Why do we privilege this idea of legal effects? Because some legal effects might be quite trivial. I might have a consumer claim worth £20 and it might be dealt with by some relatively informal decision-making mechanism, but it's a legal dispute, it's affecting my legal rights. So that is odd. And what do we mean by things that are similar to legal effects? Similar in what way? The GDPR recitals give us two examples. One is the automatic refusal of an online credit application, and the other is e-recruiting practices without human intervention. So the assumption seems to be, well, they wouldn't be producing legal effects, but they would be producing similarly significant effects. Well, hang on, why wouldn't they be producing legal effects? E-recruiting either ends in a contract of employment or doesn't. Why isn't that a legal effect? So I think these concepts are quite opaque. One you might like to think about, for instance, is deciding somebody's degree class. Let's say that degree classification was dealt with by solely automated means with no human examiners. I can imagine a lot of academics would be delighted by that prospect. Does your degree class produce legal effects? I'm not sure that it does. I mean, if you have a first class honours degree, it doesn't actually entitle you to anything, though I think quite a lot of people assume that it does in various ways. But certainly in terms of its impact on your life chances, your degree class can be highly significant. So then we've got this distinction between what I call the red light cases and the amber light cases. So why is a decision that involves special category data a red light case? You remember, special category data is specifically defined in Article 9, covering things like health, sexual, your sex life, your religious beliefs, and so forth. So we've got these specific categories of data. But at the point where we say, well, those are red light, that's a red light case, we're focusing there on the type of data being processed rather than on the effect. That looks odd. So, and then the recognised legitimate interest, the new basis for processing. Why is that a red light case? It's not clear to me at all. So we've got this amended structure. It's cut back on the scope of Article 22 as it originally was. That's to say it's more permissive of solely automated decision making. I think there are still some real questions as to how these definitions are going to work in practice. I mean, one of the bases on which these amendments were put forward was they're clarifying. Well, I still think there's a lot for lawyers to argue about. As I've said, there was a proposal to get rid of Article 22 altogether. That came in May 2021 in a report from something called the Task Force on Innovation, Growth and Regulatory Reform, which deliberately or not gives you the acronym TIGER. I think I'm perhaps more Eeyore than TIGER when it comes to automated decision making. Now, their recommendation, put shortly, was that you should get rid of Article 22 because it was seen as a barrier to innovation. Instead, roughly speaking, you should leave it to the general principles in the rest of the GDPR to deal with automated decision making. So if you think there's a problem with bias, for example, you pick that up under the fairness duties in Article 5 of the GDPR. You don't need a special provision. That recommendation after consultation wasn't proceeded with. Instead, we got the proposed amendments, which ultimately gave us the version of Article 22, which we now have post the 2025 Act. So what's the point? What's the point of the provision? What happens if we get rid of the provision? Now, you might say, well, the point of the provision is obvious. We can't have solely automated decision-making about important things because we simply can't trust the technology to be good enough. And since ChatGPT burst on everybody's consciousness in early 2022, we've heard a great deal about AI-generated hallucinations, including in the legal system itself, including some hallucinated cases finding their way into submissions made by lawyers in court. That's caused a great schmozzle. So, of course, we can't trust computers to make decisions on their own. But hang on a minute. Okay, so computer systems are, in some respects, not 100% reliable. As compared with what? As compared with human decision makers? So human decision makers are 100% reliable. So if we were saying, well, our concern is with reliability, then surely what you'd have to do is look at, is this an area where humans are more reliable than computers or vice versa? The other thing is, if our concern is just about the reliability of solely automated decision making, that's contingent. That's essentially saying, well, the systems we've got at the moment aren't good enough to trust them 100%. But perhaps in 5 years' time or 10 years' time or whatever, they will be, at any rate, in some domains. So I think just saying it's about reliability, we need to probe further. Well, what about the GDPR? Does the GDPR itself give us any clues as to why we should have special rules about automated decisions, solely automated decisions? And I think there are two specific concerns that you can pick up from the GDPR. One is about bias. Recital 71 to the GDPR talks about bias in the context of profiling, but the notion of profiling is closely related to the notion of automatic decision making. And it says that if you use profiling as a controller, you've got to prevent discriminatory effects on natural persons on the basis of racial or ethnic origin, political opinion, religion or beliefs, etc. And of course, in relation to profiling and automated decision, generally, there's an enormous literature about bias. There's lots of concern about how if there's bias in the training data, it's replicated in the system. But if your concern is about bias, then you can sweep that up within a general concept of fairness. You don't need a special rule like Article 22. Then the other concern that's in play on the face of the GDPR is a concern about transparency. And there are particular provisions, as you know, that require privacy notices with some very prescriptive information that has to be provided. And one of the things that you have to tell people about is the existence of automated decision making. Now, obviously, we all know that transparency is really important under the GDPR. But again, if your concern is about transparency, that's not a basis for banning solely automated decision making. That's a basis for saying you need to tell people about it. That's a different issue. So I think we need to probe a bit further to say, well, what is the justification for this kind of provision? And I want to look at two interventions in the debate, which I think have been interesting. One came from Lord Sales, who is currently the Deputy President of the Supreme Court. And I think of all of our judges, he's probably the one who has the biggest academic footprint and the biggest hinterland in terms of making interesting interventions into legal and policy debates. So very often, judges are quite cautious at what they say in public, which can mean that a lecture by a judge is actually quite dull. And that does not apply to Philip Sales. So he gave a lecture on algorithms, artificial intelligence, and the law back in 2019. So, I mean, prehistory in terms of some of the things that we're talking about. And he talked about the problem which he saw as going back to Aristotle about the risks of undue rigidity in the application of legal rules and the need for flexibility, or what's sometimes translated as equity, in the actual application of the law. And Lord Sales said, well, if you have an algorithmic decision-making system, you can't achieve that. But he recognized that, again, that's contingent, because that's assuming that you have an algorithmic system based on fairly fixed and flexible rules. If you have a system based on the kind of technology that we're now seeing, it's not necessarily going to be inflexible in that way. So to say, well, machine decision-making is too inflexible, the answer might be, well, sometimes it is, but sometimes it isn't. So more recently, in 2023, there was a lecture by John Tassioulis, the 2023 Elson Ethics Lecture. So John Tassioulis was the former director of the AI Ethics Center in a different university. And his discussions focused specifically on judicial decisions, but I think a lot of what he said is applicable to the wider context of Article 22. And he imagines what he calls a legal Turing test. So imagine you have a system that can produce a decision that is indistinguishable to a sophisticated observer, indistinguishable from a judicial decision by a human judge. Passes a legal Turing test. You couldn't tell the difference. And he says, well, here, the product of the human decision-making process and the automated decision-making process, the product is the same. But he says, well, we still all have concerns about the process. And he comes up with three reasons why we might care about whether a human process is followed. One is to do with explainability. Can you explain why the decision was taken? And I think that links in to the expectation of reasons for the decision, for a decision. When a human decision maker gives a decision, we may expect them to give reasons. When an automated system spits out a decision, it may give you reasons, but do those reasons relate to the decision in the same way that the human reasons would relate to the decision? When you're decision-making as a human, it's an iterative process. Sometimes the process of trying to put your decision, trying to give reasons for your decision, makes you rethink the decision in the first place, whether you got it right. I'm not convinced that that would apply with an automated system. So that's one area, explainability. John Tassioulis suggested a second area, which was answerability. Is the decision-maker answerable? Are they accountable? And if so, in what way? And then the third is what he calls solidarity. He says when a human stands in judgment over another human, there's a solidarity in play, furnished by the fact that they both possess and have the opportunity to exercise their rational natures. And he gives the example of mercy and empathy And he says, well, a human being might feel empathy and show mercy in a particular situation. A machine might be able to replicate an expression of empathy and replicate an empathic decision, but that's a different matter. So I think we can perhaps push on a bit, building on that idea of solidarity, because what we're getting to here, seems to me to be the heart of the matter, which is that we're nervous about automated decision making, not just because there might be some contingent concerns about whether our current decision making systems are accurate or not, but because of some more fundamental concerns that there's something inconsistent with human dignity about the idea of being subjected to a wholly automated decision making process on something important. So we could perhaps start with a notion of human well-being or human flourishing. This is building on what John Tassiulis calls solidarity. I would suggest that the sorts of decisions that we should principally care about in relation to provisions like Article 22, automated decision-making, are decisions that affect focal aspects of human well-being. And obviously, we can have a big argument about what those focal aspects might be. Now, if that's right, if that's the right way of thinking about it, I'm not convinced that Article 22, as it stands, as amended, really hits that target, because where it talks about legal or comparably significant effects, clearly it's trying to get at the idea that there are some decisions that are particularly important and that we particularly care about, and that those are the decisions where we should be looking to impose some controls on automated decision-making. But I'm not sure that the context of the concept of having legal effects really captures that. So let's go with the idea that perhaps what we might care about is decisions that affect focal aspects or central aspects of human well-being. So that might include things like access to financial resources. And that was an example that was given in the GDPR in Recycle 71. Something would come within Article 22 because there was the example of being turned down for credit by an automated system. Or access to employment. And then again, that was another GDPR example. So an automated recruitment system, which decides who should get a particular job, or possibly an automated decision-making system that decides who should be shortlisted, leaving it to the human decision-makers to decide who should actually get the job. Or perhaps access to healthcare or access to educational opportunities, deciding who gets into a university, or the example I gave earlier, deciding at what degree class you get. If you have a decision-maker who is human, then you can say, these decisions about important aspects of my flourishing are being made by somebody for whose own flourishing those things would likewise be important. So there's an element of reciprocity there. It's perhaps analogous to the idea of being tried by a jury of my peers. I think another comparison I've heard made is that being a human in a world of entirely automated decision-making is a little bit like being a colonial subject. And the colonial government may be really good in some ways, in the sense that, you know, it may provide law and order and roads and transport and the rest of it, but you might still think, well, I don't want to be a colonial subject. I don't want to be in a fundamentally unequal subordinate position. So I started with that notion of human flourishing as something that humans share. It's not at all clear what would constitute flourishing for an automated decision-making system, or even if the concept has any purchase there at all. I like the example of RACTA. Now, RACTA was an early program from the 1980s that purported to generate language, including poetry, So purportedly machine-written poetry. I say purportedly because I think there's quite a lot of argument as to how much of it was really machine-written and how much of it was human-written. But be that as it may, in 1983, a book of poetry was published, supposedly by Racta, with the charming title, The Policeman's Beard is Half Constructed. Here's a sample, which has a bearing on the issue of well-being. Racta wrote this, more than iron, more than lead, more than gold. I need electricity. I need it more than I need lamb or pork or lettuce or cucumber. I need it for my dreams. So you could say that human well-being and machine well-being, if there is such a thing, are both affected by the availability or not of electricity, plainly in radically different ways. Racta's well-being is very different from mine. I think another concept I think is interesting in this context is to introduce the concept of attention as something that carries moral weight and significance. So there's quite a rich philosophical literature about how the notion of paying attention, and specifically paying attention to another person, carries moral weight in and of itself, separate from the question of how you treat them. And there's an example in some work by Iris Murdoch, the novelist, who of course was also a philosopher as well as a novelist. And probably her best known work of philosophy is The Sovereignty of Good, which she published in 1970. And she was attacking this notion of ethics as being essentially about decision making. And she said, no, how we pay attention to people is fundamental. If you pay attention to people in the right way, you find that the decisions will often take themselves. And she told a story as an example of that. She said, imagine the case of a woman who secretly despises her daughter-in-law, treats her daughter-in-law impeccably, but secretly despises her. Over time, the woman reassesses her view, comes to see that it was unjust, and revises it. And Iris Murdoch says, well, that is important for its own sake. It's important regardless of whether it cashes out in terms of observable behavior. Even if the daughter-in-law is overseas and they never meet, even if the daughter-in-law is dead, it still matters. And Iris Murdoch sees this story in terms of learning justly to pay attention to the exterior world. Now, machine decision-making, unlike human decision-making, can't involve paying attention to a person in that sense. However much data you crunch, however sophisticated are the mathematical tools that sharpen the jaws that do the crunching. So what are we doing if we automate decision making? One of the things that we're doing is reducing the scope in the world for the development of a characteristically human form of excellence. So the excellence that comes from learning to pay attention to the world in a good way, and therefore learning to be the sort of person who makes good decisions and good judgments. And if you view matters from the point of view of the person about whom decisions are made, this kind of paying attention is a recognition of their dignity and their worth. And it's a dignity that they have by virtue of their human personhood. And I would suggest that subjecting a person to automated decision-making doesn't recognize their dignity and worth in the same way. Now, all of that, I can imagine, might seem very far removed from the humdrum world of doing things like credit scoring or marking the 67th exam paper that you have to do following finals or anything like that. But I think it's the very fact that those things are routine and pervasive and also important as to whether people's lives go well or badly that gives them some moral weight and significance. So I suggest our choices about how these things are done, they both reflect and they constitute our shared understanding of what we can properly expect from one another as human persons. Now, you could say, well, that is all very high flown. But what it forgets is the fallibility of the human. And I made the point a while back that if you think AI decision making involves, say, hallucination, well, what about the ways that human decision making can go wrong? And human decision making in itself can carry its own costs. And I think this is the most powerful argument in favor of some degree of automated decision making. And what are the costs of human decision making? I think we can think in terms of at least four things. One is delay. If you've got a difficult, important decision that is being made conscientiously by the sort of decision maker who is formed by the sort of considerations that people like John Tassioulis and Iris Murdoch write about, that takes time. Do we really want to spend that time? So if you have, say, minor consumer disputes to be resolved, we want to take the time that that kind of decision-making would involve. So that's one cost, delay and time. I think another cost is expense. So kind of Rolls-Royce decision-making process generates costs, and those costs have got to be borne somewhere, whether they're borne by government, which ultimately means taxpayers, or whether they're borne by the private sector, which ultimately is likely to mean they're passed on to consumers in some way. So it may be we say, well, automated decision-making is cheaper. There's then human bias. So we worry about machine bias. We also worry about human bias. Indeed, the reason that we worry about machine bias is partly that machines may be trained on human data, which has got bias baked into it. We also have what we might call noise. So by bias, I'm thinking of things like a bias against people on grounds of sex, on grounds of race, on grounds of sexual orientation, matters of that nature. By noise, I'm thinking of much more random things. I made a particular decision hastily because I was sleeping, or I was hungry, or I just happened to have been recently really annoyed by something quite extraneous and I was distracted. That's noise. So sure, there are costs in human decision-making as well. So I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that we should simply throw out the whole idea of automated decision-making as being incompatible with some sort of notion of human dignity. I think what I want to argue is that a provision like Article 22, even if it's imperfect, is recognizing something that is of genuine importance. And that when we move from human decision making to automated decision making, in pursuit of these perhaps Tiggerish goals of efficiency or innovation, then sure, there are benefits, but there are potentially costs as well. And I think what we need to think about in a very sophisticated way is what are the things that machines are good at and what are the things that human beings are good at. And I might perhaps finish with a medical example. So one of the tasks that oncologists might carry out is looking at scans to see whether a scan shows a tumor that requires further investigation or not. And you don't want to err on the side of safety. You want to get it right, because if you do too many investigations, then that means that the people who really need further investigation happen to wait for it. That job of looking at the scan and seeing, is this a tumor that needs further investigation? If the machines can do that better and more accurately than the humans, then let them at it. But a separate thing, you might want to have a discussion. If you have a cancer diagnosis, is it worth having a treatment that will prolong your life, but will mean that during the remaining life, you'll spend most of the time feeling extremely sick? Is that worth doing? Is it worth doing it if it means you live to see your daughter's wedding, which you wouldn't otherwise do? On that sort of thing, you might want the assistance of a human decision maker rather than a machine. So I think there are some quite profound issues when one starts to think about the balance between human decision-making and solely automated decision-making. I think what is interesting about Article 22, for all the questions that one can ask about it, and for all the points of interpretation that it potentially throws up, the interesting thing about Article 22 is that it is actually an attempt to grapple with these issues and draw some dividing lines as to context in which we're happy to have solely automated decision-making and the context in which we're not happy to have that kind of decision-making. And it's really interesting. We were having this discussion before this seminar started, that with all of the discussion that has been over the last few years about machine decision-making, there seems to be remarkably little awareness of Article 22. Various people saying, well, we need to regulate this area. We need to regulate AI. Well, in one very important way, we've already done so. And the existence of that regulation, I think, is quite often overlooked. So I'm going to end it there. We've got about 15 minutes for questions, observations. If anybody wants to tell me I'm a terrible Luddite, then now is your opportunity.
Oh, well, we should start by thanking.